This is the She Meeting, the October meeting 2010. I'm Thelma English, and most of you know that I am Krista's mother-in-law, so Lord bless her in spite of that. I'm quite the exciting mother-in-law, I'm sure. You can talk about that when I'm not here. Krista's an incredible daughter-in-law. She's my dream come true. She's what I wished for forever for our oldest son, and we got her. So we just need one more. One more like Krista, and we'll be happy. So what we're doing tonight, I'm here to encourage you. And I'm here to teach you some really fun Bible facts that will encourage you and kind of empower you to feel confident teaching your kids Bible at home. And these are all free things. This is all free. And the first thing that I want to encourage you to do is something that I actually require all of my students to do. I'm teaching an Old Testament survey class this year, and I require my students to go home and download eSword. eSword is all free. They do have things you can buy there, but I don't buy anything. It's all free. eSword, the programs you can get at eSword are the equivalent of a good Bible Works program. My first year of seminary 10 years ago, my master's studies are in exegetical theology here at Western Seminary in Portland. And 10 years ago when I started seminary, I went out and I spent $350 on Bible Works 10 years ago. And I'm going to tell you that eSword is just as good, as long as you're not trying to parse Hebrew verbs. eSword has everything that you need. Your kids should be downloading this. If you have teenagers, they should have this on their computers. What you do is you go to eSword, and it says downloads. It's very user-friendly. If you have a Mac, you don't even need to listen. You'll have to use some other product. This is PC-friendly only. How many here are Mac? I'm really sorry. And as of yet, there isn't an equivalent. But this is all free. So you go and you download this module, and what it is an eSword empty box, basically. Then you go to the downloads, and you choose what you're going to put in your eSword box, and I'm telling you, just choose all the free ones. I made this into a PowerPoint for my students. Do I have this on? I made it into a PowerPoint for my students so that I could get them excited. Well, no, it ought to. It ought to be running. Going, let's see, we've got that one up. Let me try this other. Port, and see if it will like that one. Oh, where are my kids when I need help? See, in class I have TAs, and I never have to do this by myself. Is there anybody here who's computer friendly who would have any idea why my remote is not talking? Let's see. Yep. My PowerPoint's on. My slides are not progressing. So I'm trying to think of why my slides would not progress. Let's see if I can switch modes here. And I might be able to progress just with buttons. Otherwise, we'll just wing it. Oh, I can just progress this way. We'll do this. The PowerPoint presentation that I brought in this evening is a quickie anyway. This is to whet your appetite for eSword. I put together about 30 slides, and I'm going to whiz through them really fast. This is to impress you so that you will go home and you'll all download eSword. You'll be so excited. Even if you've done a little bit of Greek, you can use eSword. Most of it is all English. You can see that this is a very sophisticated software, very sophisticated Bible software. You can even set up eSword so that in your Word program, on your help menu, you have an eSword icon. You can tell eSword you're going to allow it to go into your Word program so that when you're typing in Word, you can click on eSword and access those and then use those to put those into papers or Bible study lessons, Sunday school lessons. It's an incredible resource. So what all can you get at eSword for free? Parallel Bibles, which would include English versions, and then also foreign languages and Hebrew and Greek if you have been so blessed to do any Greek or Hebrew. You can create study notes where you're looking to do word studies. Strong's on eSword is free. This is a free resource. Most of you have some of these books on your shelves that you paid money for. These are free. Commentaries, dictionaries, multiple sets of commentaries and dictionaries. I have some of these, and you know, these are $20 to $300 sets, and these are the ones on eSword. These are free. You can explore other translations. Here's an English translation, and you've got the Strong's numbers so that you can look at it in Greek, look up the word, do a word study using the Greek. You can do incredible searches so that you can search for part or all of a word doing word searches. Graphics viewers are absolutely incredible so that you can have, you have all the way from maps to NASA photographs so that you can see this is the Egyptian Delta, that rich area, the end of the Fertile Crescent. They have step readers with hundreds of free books that you put into this step reader and can read a book. This is part of the Church Fathers set. I own these. You get about 30 volumes for $300, early Church Fathers. However, this way you can search them. So what I do for my classes is I do word searches through the electronic free version. Then I go to my paper version and take it into class so that the kids know what I'm talking about. That would be these. These are free. I paid a lot of money for these. Matthew Henry's commentary, these are free. The Jameson Fawcett Brown, typical Protestant commentary, free. Kyle and Delitzsch commentary, you don't have to know any Hebrew to use these. Hebrew might be helpful, but there are the Kyle and Delitzsch commentary, for example, on Isaiah 7 is unparalleled in literature for the last 200 years. Commentary on Isaiah coming from Kyle and Delitzsch, knowing no Hebrew. These men have an amazing, it's an astounding amount of research that they have done into the greater prophets and the Book of 12, the lesser prophets. And I spent $100 for those, my paper copies, and those are free on eSort, and they're searchable. Word pictures of the New Testament, these have been extremely popular for 150 years. Your pastor probably uses these. Word pictures, this is so that when Paul says, we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, A.T. Robertson will expound that to you and explain to you the imagery behind that and unpack those metaphors so that you can see, according to the culture that Paul's living in that first century, what he's referring to. Incredible, incredible. Word pictures basically means he's unpacking all the metaphors. Treasury of David, look up any psalm that you like and Spurgeon will explicate it. You can look up your favorite psalm and learn the circumstances, the historical context, who wrote it, what was happening to them at the time that they wrote this, and then you can add these into your Bible. You can still buy these for $30 or $40 for the set of three, but of course they're free and they're searchable on eSort. Vincent's New Testament Word Studies, if you've had any Greek, if you've had some Greek, these might be interesting to you. Otherwise, they're probably off limits. Brown Driver Briggs, if you've done Hebrew, if you take a Hebrew class, this is a $60 book, free on eSort. Easton's Bible Dictionary, Fawcett's Bible Dictionary, these are free Bible dictionaries. They are not always conservative because everything basically about 50 years ago was turned a little bit liberal. Now I'm going to tell you how to spot a liberal resource. Let's say you go to Powell's or you go to a garage sale or you go to the Goodwill and you see an Old Testament survey book or a book about the Old Testament and you wonder, is this okay or not? Is it conservative theology or is it liberal theology? And I'll tell you, your test case is Isaiah. Go to the section on Isaiah. Go to the section on Isaiah and look and see at the introductory material for Isaiah, how many Isaiahs are there? If there is one Isaiah, if they tell you about the hypothesis of three and then tell you why that doesn't work and why there's only one, it is conservative theology. If they tell you that there are three Isaiahs, it's liberal. And if you're not liberal, you're not going to like it. So that's your test case for Old Testament materials. Look up Isaiah. Look up Isaiah in a Bible dictionary. Look up his name in a dictionary, and you'll know whether it's a liberal or conservative material. These dictionaries have some semi-liberal things in them, but they're extremely valuable. You can look up Noah. You can look up Joseph, Jacob, Abraham, and have all of those little details. You know, what if you need to know the names of Keturah's, Abraham's second wife? What if you need to know the names of her six sons? You could look up Keturah and find out her six sons and find out, oh my goodness, one of her six sons is Midian. Oh my goodness, he becomes the father of the Midianites. Wasn't that kind of a poor choice Abraham made there? Let's see. Well, I'm a woman. I think like a woman. eSort dictionaries, the American Dictionary, many of you spent, what, $59 on this?
$70.
$70, okay, free on eSort. Free on eSort, and it's searchable, cut and pastable. Cut and pastable. Put this into your school lessons, Sunday school lessons.
This is my luxury item on the list.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ISBE, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. This is still about $100. You can buy it at CBD, you know, the Christian book. They're not always conservative, for example, in Isaiah, but for most things they are conservative. They are free. Nave's Topical Bible, that's a cool one, free. Thayer's Greek English Lexicon, you wouldn't need much Greek to be able to use this, coded with Strong's Concordance numbers. This is about a $60 book, free. Greek New Testament, if you're into Greek, free. Hebrew Old Testament, free, with Strong's. The Greek Old Testament, Septuagint, and actually they have a new one, free. I did not make a slide for the ESV. The new version, the English Standard Version, the ESV, the hot new Bible in the last few years, free on ESORD. NIV hasn't released copyright. New American Standard hasn't released copyright. ESV, it's free. ESV is free. You can download it for free on ESORD. The American Bible Society, all of their maps are free. And, of course, that means Abraham's journeys, all of the journeys besides basic maps, and it's all free. You have a whole atlas there. Incredible graphics so that you can go from your text to the graphics. And what happens, let's say you download the ESV Bible, and then let's say you download 3 Bible dictionaries, 2 Bible encyclopedias, 6 commentaries, and then you're reading in Genesis 3:16, and you think, I wonder what that means, Genesis 3:16. And everything that you have downloaded that has something to say about that verse that you just highlighted pops up with a little thought type, like an upside down raindrop, saying, me, me, me. And so all the resources you downloaded, everything that will address that verse that you just highlighted is screaming to be opened up so that you will read what they say about that verse. Incredible resources, and these are all free.
Thelma, do they have any, like some programs have them that you can push on audio and it will read it to you? Does this have any of those?
I don't know. That's a good question.
So that's the battle I'm having right now, is I'd like to just put
okay.
But yeah. When it's done with one verse, I have to go back. So like Genesis 1, and then once done.
Okay, I do not know. Yeah, that I do not know. Graphics, you have multiple graphics available. This, for example, this is a cool graphics. Who is this about? This is, oh, some famous person in all of their travels. I can't tell. Somebody who went to Egypt, Rome, Greece, Assyria. Oh, maybe this is dispersion after the first century or something. I'm not sure. Atlases. If you're into art, if you like Gustave Doré's, all his cool stuff, it's all there. It's all free. NASA satellite images. I love these. I make my kids memorize this, my kids in my class, so that they know, okay, there's the Sea of Galilee. It's connected by the Jordan River. Down below is the Dead Sea. If you go to the top of the Dead Sea, go over west to the west coast, divide that into 3 pieces, and go one-third of the way over, that's Jerusalem at that high point on that mountain. You don't need a map with words on it to find Jerusalem if you have the bodies of water. So, and Dan would be just above the Sea of Galilee. Beersheba would be near the bottom of the picture. Petra is over in those mountains, the lower right. Once you start looking at atlases, and have your kids learn, have them look at a satellite image and say, look for the mountains. You see the valley? That's the Jordan Valley. You see that mountain? That's where Jerusalem is. Things like that. This is all free. Antiquity of the Jews, if you're into Josephus, there's some cool stuff. It's all free. Fox's Book of Martyrs, this is all free. History of the Christian Church, I paid $180 for these. Free. Institutes, John Calvin, unless you're Wesleyan, then you're probably not interested. Calvin, you know, he's my hero. Free. And Alfred Edersheim, the Jewish guy turned Christian who kind of rewrote Josephus and History of the Jews. Fascinating on Jewish social life. William Ramsey, this is a classic on Paul. You could read this and you'd have half the New Testament memorized just from going through this. Another Edersheim book, Jesus the Messiah. Edersheim, how else do you know how do they clean the Holy of Holies? Alfred Edersheim will tell you in his book. how they clean the walls in the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Okay, now let's do a little bit of biblical exegesis based on the text of Genesis. So if you have your Bible, you can open up. We're going to look at this because it's interesting to women. Now remember, your object tonight is to learn a little bit about the Bible and go home really excited to teach your kids about the Bible. And we're going to do a historical outline in a bit, but first we're going to do just a little bit of exegesis. So if you have a Bible, you can open it up and be looking at Genesis 3:16 and Genesis 4:7. These are very unusual verses, and the ESV, I'll tell you, the ESV, can you hand that to me, Krista? Thank you. The ESV is the first Bible to address and correct this issue, and this is really cool of interest for women. So that's why we're going to look at it here tonight. So Genesis 3:16 and 4:7. So Genesis 3:16 says, and this is part of the curse, right? They've already sinned, and God says to the serpent, he says, you know, because you've done this, you're going to crawl on your belly, you're cursed. And then he says, and then we have that first direct expression of the gospel of the Bible, verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. He'll bruise your head, you'll bruise his heel, this first thing. Then verse 16, to the woman he said, and this is really important for us as women. To the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Now this is the important part. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. What on earth does that mean? Your desire will be. Does it mean he's going to be cuter? You know, and you desire him more? What does that mean? The answer lies in 4:7. The answer lies in 4:7. Let's look at 4:7. Now they have more children. She bore Cain and says, I've gotten a man. In 4:5, Cain is very angry. His face falls. The Lord says to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, that you must rule over it. Now I'm going to tell you that the construction in the Hebrew of 3:16 and 4:7 is identical except for gender. They are identical expressions. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And speaking to Cain, sin, its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Now let's look at Cain. We know what that means. Sin desires him. But he has to master it. He has to rule over it, right? So what does this mean for the woman? Now that we know what 4:7 means, we now know what 3:16 means. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. What's her desire? To rule over her husband. That's her desire. That's part of our curse, ladies. Doesn't that make you feel good? Doesn't that make you feel good? Don't you wonder why you're always trying to butt in and take over? Your desire, and it's the same word. It's the same Hebrew expression. The words are identical, only the gender is changed. It cannot mean something different in 3:16 than it does in 4:7. It simply can't. And the ESV is the first Bible translation to fix that. I do have other gripes with the ESV and other sections of Scripture. I'm not giving them blanket approval. You're always going to be best, of course, in the Hebrew or the Greek. But we can't always do that, can we? Forget, this isn't going to work for me tonight. Okay, so that was your little fun bit of exegesis.
Sobering, really.
Well, it is sobering, but isn't that good to know? It's not just you. It's not just me. It's an all-over thing. Women want to rule over their husbands, but their husbands must rule over them. Their husbands must master them. You can only have one president. Only one person can be at the top in charge. But that helps us to realize why we try so hard to take over from our husbands. It works for me. Okay, let's see, we did that. And toledoth. Now we'll have some fun with toledoth. Have you ever heard of a toledoth? Okay, toledot, it's a Hebrew word, and it's pronounced toledot. Okay, that's the Hebrew word, toledot. And it means generation. This is something fun and interesting, and the people behind this would be Dr. Henry Morris, who is now dead, who generally gets respect from most people, Dr. Ruth Beechick. Both of them would propound this theory of toledot signatures, and I want to share this with you. This is really fun. I want you to look at these places in Genesis at these toledots, and look at these statements. For example, I think I have them all on slides here. Genesis 2:4, Genesis 5:1a, Genesis 10:1, Genesis 11:10, Genesis 36:1, Genesis 36:9, and Genesis 37:2. They seem to mark the end of an historical account. Let's take a look. Genesis 2:4, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made the heavens and the earth. And you know, Lord, when it's all caps like that, is Yahweh, his given name, and God, of course, is Elohim. So this is Yahweh Elohim. Made the heavens, the earth, and the heavens. Genesis 5:1a. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Genesis 6:9a. These are the generations of Noah. Do you see some similarities there? And each one of those verses that I gave you, they all finish like this. This is the book of the generations of, and it goes to Shem, and it then to Shem's sons. You see something in sequence here. Common modern writing practices, these colophons, these signatures, are found at the end of a text, not at the beginning. We would say, this is the Journal of Thelma English, and then we would write it. But the Hebrews, the ancient cultures, they would write their journal, write their history, and then say, these are the generations of Noah. And what we may have here are actual signatures for lesser scrolls that then Moses put together to make, to put together the Torah and the Tanakh. It's a tablet theory. It's called a tablet theory. And this guy, I'm going to rush through this. We won't read them all. This guy named P.J. Wiseman got interested in archaeology in the Bible area, and especially because they found so many clay tablets. And we don't really have very many from the time of Abraham. And these clay tablets were from before the time of Abraham. And he's thinking, oh my goodness, these languages are almost like Hebrew. If we can read these, we can learn more about the culture and the original writings of the early Bible, especially the book of Genesis. This book, I'll be reading this year. I have to have this book now that I know it exists. His son wrote a book. He's a professor of Assyriology, and he has just redone his father's book, and it's called Ancient Records and the Structure of Genesis. Thomas Nelson, who is a reputed publisher, anything by Thomas Nelson will generally, they publish the Bible, a lot of Bibles, generally will be reputable and conservative. And what this guy found is that most of the clay tablets had colophon phrases at the end. And these phrases at the end label who wrote it or who wrote it or who owned the tablet. They're at the end. And that helped us with these Genesis declarations at the end to realize, oh my goodness, it's a cultural thing. That's the way that they did it. They wrote it at the end. And they have catch lines to connect it to the next tablet. The next person who's going to be writing, they have a little catch line. Absolutely fascinating. Most scholars have noticed Genesis is divided into sections, definitely, separated by these phrases, these are the generations of. And the Hebrew word for generation is toledot, that means, you know, history, the generation, story of their origin. Most scholars recognize that these toledot phrases must be important, but we always thought that they were the headings, and then they didn't make sense. It led to serious questions because they don't seem to fit in all circumstances. But Wiseman saw the colophons were at the end, not at the beginning, so he applied this idea to the toledot phrases in Genesis, and guess what? It works in every case. In every case, it makes sense. So that's kind of your fun thing. Now, what about dating Abraham? Did you know that we can date Abraham's birth for certain? Do you know we know the year of Abraham's birth? No conservative scholar disputes this. You can write it in the margin of your Bible. We know that Abraham was born in 2166 BC. We know he was born. We have the information to do it. Where's the information? 1 Kings 6:1 tells us that Solomon's reign was 480 years past the Exodus from Egypt. We know that the temple was begun to be built in 966, which is the fourth year of Solomon's reign. That's also in 1 Kings 6:1. The beginning of Solomon's reign was 971. No one disputes that. That's known around the world. Egyptian sources record that. It's not a disputable date. Everyone knows Solomon began reigning at 971. We are told that the temple was begun in the fourth year of his reign. That would be 966. And we are told that his reign begins 480 years after the Exodus. So do you see what all we have to do is take that date of 966, the year he starts the temple, count back 480 years. Now we have the date of the Exodus. You can write that in your Bible. It's a firm date. Someone might say 1445. Most scholars will say 1446. But when we're talking about 3,500 years ago, it's incredible that we have this amount of this level of accuracy. Per Exodus, we know that Jacob went into Egypt 430 years before the Exodus. So now we can take the date of the Exodus, 1446, add those 430 years, and we know he was 130 years old when he went in. We can add those up and get Jacob's birth. Do you see how the math works? So we know he was born in 2006. Now it's getting easy from here on out. Now we know Jacob was born when his dad Isaac was 60 years old. We are told that. So we know Isaac was born in 2066. And how old was Abraham when Isaac was born? 100. So we know Abraham's birth was 2166 B.C. Isn't that incredible? I could have read the Bible my whole life, and I would never have found that myself. But I have about 5 books on Bible chronology, and they all agree. But this is an amazing feat of math that we can date all of these people. From Abraham on, we can date. Pharaoh Shishak is one of the people who fixes us with King Solomon's reign. Solomon married some Egyptian ladies. This is one of my student assignments. I make them prove it. Week 3, they have to prove to me Abraham's birth, and that was one student. I thought she did a pretty good job, even though she did it by hand. World empires. Now we're going to divide the world of Abraham through Jesus into 400 or 500 year sections. We're going to learn about Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and the Greeks. They conveniently are A and B. Okay, the first world power is going to be Assyria. The next one is a B, Babylon, and then Persia, and then the Greeks. And after them, we get to the Romans, and we're already to the time of Christ. Okay, so we're going to look at this. Assyria basically is the world power of the world. Until 612, when Nineveh is destroyed. And, of course, Jonah's rolling over in his grave, clapping his hands. Then Babylon is going to fall. Babylon doesn't stay in power very long, do they? From 612 to 539. They fall to Persia and the Persian king Cyrus. 1 year later, in 538, Cyrus is going to issue this cylinder. If you've been to the British Museum, you may perhaps have seen the Cyrus cylinder or heard about it. Cyrus says, "What are all these Jews doing in Babylon? Let's send them home." And how long have they been here? How long was the Babylonian captivity? 70 years. Okay? So Cyrus says, send all these Jews home, and if we have any of the cool stuff from their temple that's not melted down yet, give it back to them and let them take it back. Then Persia falls, of course, to Alexander the Great. And the Greeks then get conquered by the Romans in 146. When the Romans take out Corinth, that's it. It's destroyed. It's over for the Greeks. That's it. So Assyria takes the entire Fertile Crescent. Do you understand what the Fertile Crescent is? You have a little piece. You have a little picture of the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent is that whole section in green. When people talk about the Fertile Crescent, it's a crescent-shaped fertile area of ground. And this map is a good overview of that also. You can see, I should have brought my laser pointer, you can see down in the lower left-hand corner Persia, you can see Ur, just above the word archaeology, above the G, Ur, where Abraham came from, all the way up in that arc near the Mediterranean Sea at Haran, where his father-in-law died, and he went down into Palestine, what we now call Palestine, and there was a famine, and so then he went down into Egypt, and then we know he shouldn't have done that. Let's see. So, Assyria. The Assyrian Empire is over when Nineveh falls in 612. When Nineveh's gone, that's the capital city. That's where Jonah had to go. You could walk across that city in 3 days. Huge, massive city. The Assyrians were thought to be legendary until about 180 years ago. The city of Nineveh was thought to be just a Christian legend in the Old Testament. It was thought to be made up. Nobody really thought there was a Nineveh. Nobody really thought there was a prophet Jonah. Nobody really thought that he went anywhere. After the time of Darwin's Origin of the Species, 1859, scholarship went very liberal. Biblical scholarship went, theology went very liberal. And it was thought that most of the things in the Old Testament were legendary. Now we know, with almost 200 years of excavations, we realize, oh my goodness, every one of these cities is really there. And when Henry Laird dug up Nineveh in the 1850s, I believe, 1860s, when he dug up Nineveh, there it was, just like the Bible said, absolutely. And city after city has been dug up, and we see, oh my goodness, it's exactly. Jericho. Jericho was burned to the ground with the grain in the jars. You never burn a city to the ground and leave the grain in the jars. You would always steal the grain. That's too valuable. You would take all the grain, you would loot them for everything that they're worth, then you'd burn their city to the ground. But remember, they were told that Jericho had, they were to devote it all to destruction. It had to be burned to the ground, and that's what they find, the grain in the jars, just as the biblical account tells us. We have no reason to discount anything in the Old Testament at this point. No reason at all. Then Babylon's going to fall. You know that. There's Alexander. I just had to show you the beautiful mosaic. It's now in the museum at Naples. Christo's seen the reproduction of this at Pompeii. The original was in Pompeii, and they had some graduate students dig it up. The replica now is what we get to look at when we go to Pompeii, and the real one's in the museum in Naples. That's what they always do. This is the city of Corinth. Christa's been there too. This is the Pirene Springs. This is where the Apostle Paul lived for 18 months. He would have come to these springs probably every day and got water and stood around talking to people and talking about tent making and things like that. All right, now we're going to use the whiteboard. We're going to switch to the whiteboard. Oh, look at that. Isn't that cute? Isn't that cute? Why, look at that cute girl and her family. Isn't that sweet? What can I say? Okay. So now we'll use the whiteboard. I'll grab some pens. And do you want me to keep this to like another 10 minutes or what works? Is 10 minutes too long?
No.
Okay. Now, are you having any fun?
Yes.
Okay. Usually anytime we learn anything about the Bible, we have so much fun that it gets pretty exciting pretty quick. Normally I have a massive whiteboard. I thought about writing on the wall. The Sunday school could use it. They could leave it up and they could use it.
It's just incredible.
What?
Right over all of it. Just all the...
This is a little booklet that I put together for my students. I put this together for my students. Every date that I've slid by you on that PowerPoint, every date is here. So the talk helps to put it in context. Every date that I'm going to put up on this little minuscule whiteboard is also here. The dates that are in red or blue, my students are responsible to have memorized by the end of the year. And you know, if you're part of the She group, if you want, you can go to Thelma's Library. You can go to my website online. And if you want to sign up for that class, all you have to do is send me an email and say, we want to take your class. And anybody in the She group can do it for free, because this is my daughter-in-law's group. Kids pay $500 in Oregon City to take this class. Now, I'm not going to correct your papers, but I do put up, in the teacher section, I put up corrected student work samples. I scan them in so you can see how I graded and how other kids did their work and compare. It's definitely advanced level material, but I have a 7th grader and an 8th grader in my classes this year, and they're not taking calculus or physics or chemistry, and so they're doing really good in it because this is their big class. This is the big thing they're doing. Okay, so now we'll look at more of these dates, but this is fun. We'll look at this for another second. This is really cool. So you have the Fertile Crescent, then open to these. I've been to Europe 5 times. I've been to the British Museum. I've seen these things for real. We have photos of these. This is incredible history. There's a little town called Lachish, very near Jerusalem. It's kind of southwest of Jerusalem. When Sennacherib came down, when Hezekiah was king of Jerusalem in 701 BC, that'd be 2 Kings 18 and 19, when Sennacherib came down, he surrounded Jerusalem, and remember, 185,000 of his troops were slain by an angel of the Lord. Okay, that situation. Just before Sennacherib went to Jerusalem, he had already destroyed Lachish. He had already destroyed their neighbor. He had destroyed all the neighbors. And this is what he did to the Hebrews at Lachish. These are the only known images of Hebrew people. Very few images of Hebrew people. And of course, these aren't very pretty pictures. These are Israelite captives from Lachish. And the bottom is, this is from Sennacherib's wall relief at Nineveh in Assyria. These are now in the British Museum. These are Lachish Israelites being skinned alive. It's a depiction in stone. If you went to Assyria and you went to Nineveh and you sent a convoy, a peace convoy, to say, please don't take our city, you're going to walk by all these reliefs. of what the Assyrians have done to their enemies. When the Assyrians come and surround your city, when they surround the city like Jerusalem, like Sennacherib did in 701 when Hezekiah was king, they surround your city. If you surrender, if you open the gates and you surrender, you just have to go into slavery and be, you know, sold all over the world. If you fight, this is what will happen. The Assyrians counted hands, heads, noses for body counts. The Assyrians were probably the most brutal people who lived on the... These are Nimrod's people. These are from Genesis 10. These are Nimrod's people, the Assyrians and then the Babylonians. So when Hezekiah, when Sennacherib surrounds Jerusalem and Hezekiah goes into the temple and spreads this letter and says, God, they say all the other gods couldn't save them. Are you going to do anything for us? That's what Hezekiah is up against. That's what he's up against. And Hezekiah had been the smart one. He's the guy who built the tunnel, right? David, about 1000 BC, had taken the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites. It was called Jebus. Jebus, he took it from the Jebusites because he went under the waterway and got in. Some of his men got in. Hezekiah was not going to let that happen to him 300 years later. He blocked in the Gihon Spring. They dug that water tunnel 1,400 feet so that they had an internal water supply. Their enemies had no idea where the water was coming from. Hezekiah's tunnel, you can still walk through it today. So Hezekiah goes down into history for that. Let's see what other images you have in here. What I do in my classes, I try to make the Old Testament alive. You are welcome. If you want, you can send me an email. You can sign up. You can take the class. If your kids are too little to take the class, why don't you sign up and take 2 hours a week? You get 2 hours of audio every week. You have the complete schedule online. You have all of the assignments online. You read 4 chapters a day, 20 chapters a week, and you have assignments. You could do the assignments. I have 12 mothers sitting in on my Beaverton class. They just come with their kids. So eventually, when Michaela is in junior high, I'll be down here. But for now. But I'm telling you, those of you, especially if you have junior high and high school kids, junior hires who are willing to work, not little wussies, junior hires who are willing to work, junior hires who are willing to work, and then high school students who are up to a challenge, this is for you. Sorry, I know, because some of us are wussies, right? Okay, so here's your timeline. I'm going to make this timeline, instead of going this way, I'm going to make it up and down since this is such a weeny little one. Now, we're going to divide this into, four periods. Normally, you would divide them equally for a timeline, but I'm not going to do that because I don't have much material for this section. So this is 2166. This is 1446. This is 10. Do I do 1050? Yeah, this is 1050. And this is 444. If you want, you are welcome to remember these in 500-year segments, which generally works better. We're going to call this one 500, this one 1,000, this one 1,500, and this one 2,000. And we're going to, and here's the time of Christ, which would be 5 or 4 BC, but we'll call it 0 for the sake of ease. So here we have 2,000 years of Bible history. You now know some of these things already. What is it that you already know? You know the marker for the 2,000 period. Who is it? What's his name? Okay, it's Abraham. He starts conveniently with an A. Okay, 2,000, he starts conveniently with an A. Now the next one, I'm going to tell you now, starts with an M. Who's it going to be? Sure, it's going to be Moses. He starts with an M. And he ends with an S. Who do you think the S is going to be? Sure, it's going to be Solomon. Do you see how easy this is to help you with these dates? And who do you think the N is? We haven't said his name yet, I don't think. And we're going to use Nehemiah. As soon as you have Abraham, you know the first guy starts with an A. So this is your first division of history. You have 2,000 years. We divide it into 500-year segments. The first one we're going to identify, and you can round Abraham's birth down to 2,000 instead of 2166. If you forget those dates, you have all the real dates here. But you can round it for your kids. You can say, we start with Abraham, and now you know as a parent, you'll be able to divide this. You know the M, that's going to lead you to Moses. The S is going to lead you to Solomon, and the N is going to lead you to Nehemiah. This date for Moses, for Abraham, this is the date of his birth. For Moses, this is the date of the Exodus. And for Solomon, this is the date of his reign. And for Nehemiah, this is the date of building the walls. Building the walls. Now, do you want me to take any more time or not? You want to do any more? Okay, so now we'll do some world empires, okay? Okay, now we're going to do some world empires. So we have these important things coming up. We have the Exodus, and we're going to do... Isaac is born when Abraham is how old? 100. So 2066, right? Okay, this is Isaac. This is going to lead us. Now, Jacob is born when Isaac is 60. You remember that. So we have Jacob is born in 2006. Of course, we're going back in time. Jacob went into Egypt when he was 130. Not Joseph. You're thinking Joseph. I think he was 17. Jacob, when he was 130. So now we're going up to 1876 is Jacob in Egypt. And we can do this with our kids. Jacob in Egypt. And how long was Jacob in Egypt before the Exodus? We talked about it just a little while ago. 430 years. Here's the 430 years before the Exodus. Jacob went into Egypt. And the math works here. Now the Exodus, 1446. Now we need to know, let's see, Moses dies. How long are they in the wilderness? 40 years. Okay, so Moses dies. 1406. By 1400, the conquest is pretty much complete. It's about a six-year process. Conquest is complete. When do they build the tabernacle out in the wilderness? Immediately. It's going to be 1446 or 14. Most professors will say 45. 1445. It's going to be a process, all right? So this is building the tabernacle. And you can count on it. You can tell your kids. My kids today in class learned the tabernacle. They can draw it just in today's lesson. They can go up to the whiteboard. They know the tabernacle enclosure is 75 feet by 150 feet. They know that the tabernacle proper is 15 by 45 feet and that it's 15. The Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, they're learning a little bit of Hebrew, is 15 by 15 by 15 a cube. And they know when you walk into the enclosure what you see. And they know when you walk into the holy place what you see. They know what's on the right, the table of showbread. They know the altar of incense is in front of them and they know the lampstand is on their left. And they learned that in an hour. We just went over and over it. If you sign up, and of course it's all free, anybody in this group, if you decide to sign up and take the class, not only do you have to listen to me talk for 2 hours every week, but you have all the PowerPoints. So when you're not just listening to me talk and looking at me scratch on the whiteboard, you have a PowerPoint of all of the things so that your kids can learn to draw the tabernacle enclosure and the tabernacle proper and learn all of those dates. I'm really trying to encourage you. Learn the Bible. Yes, we're at week, this week is session 5 out of 32, but you would open it up and start it, and you would just start working on session 1 materials, and you need 32 weeks to complete it. You would just start with session 1 anytime that you want. Okay, we know that there's 480 years between the year that Solomon starts the temple. Anybody remember what that is? He reigns in 971, and he starts the temple in the fourth year of his reign. 966 is the temple. This is the temple, which is going to be double the size of the tabernacle. Exactly double the size of the tabernacle. This is when he starts, and we know that it's 400 years. It's 480 years after the Exodus. Yes, after the Exodus of 1466, till he starts building the temple. That's that king's verse, 1 Kings 6:1. We're told 480 years. Do you see how we do the math for all this? We did it on the screen, but I'm trying to do it in a... We'll see if you think I'm doing it very good or not. Okay, the conquest is complete at 1400. Their first king is not until 1050. What do they do in between? What's in this period of history? Judges. This is your period of judges, about 350 years. This is your period of judges, and all the judges would fit in this spot. Then we come to, in the 966 date, that you have that in your booklet. It's 1 Kings 6:1. 1 Kings 6:1. Then, oh, awful of awful, we have the Assyrian Empire that's in control during this entire time, basically from the time of Nimrod. But the Assyrians are coming up, and they're going to come down. And you know that the kingdom of Israel has a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. The northern kingdom has 10 tribes. The southern kingdom has 2. The northern kingdom is basically called Israel, usually, even though it's only 10 tribes. And the southern kingdom is called Judah. We have Saul, Solomon, and David. And then in the date 931, the kingdom is divided. And from 931 on, we have kings in Israel and kings who rule over Judah. So 931 is the divided kingdom. And of course, the northern kingdom has no good kings. The southern kingdom has several. And you have kings lists in your booklet so that you can see when the kings reign. So we have a divided kingdom. This is 931. Now we're coming up to some sad dates. Let's make this 722. In 722, the Assyrians come down and the Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom. They destroy it. We call this the lost 10 tribes of Israel. After the Assyrians destroy Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. After 722, there's only Judah. There's only Judah. And Judah is quivering in her boots because the Assyrians are coming after her next. In fact, this is 722. What did I tell you already? What happens in 701? What Assyrian king comes down? Sennacherib comes down and surrounds Jerusalem and tries to take Jerusalem, and 185,000 of his troops are destroyed. He goes home with his tail between his legs, very few of them alive. 6 or 7 years later, his son Esarhaddon slaughters him in a pagan temple, and Esarhaddon takes over. So Assyria is on the downward decline. In fact, by 612, what's the greatest Assyrian city? Jonah went there, the greatest Assyrian city, and in 612, Nineveh falls. No one ever thought Nineveh would fall. Who prophesied against Nineveh? You know that was Jonah. And have you ever read Nahum? Jonah goes with some grace and mercy. Jonah doesn't want them to have grace and mercy, but God gives it to them. They're not even Jews, and God says, you can still turn. They don't. 100 and some years later, Nahum goes. Nahum sends this message to Nineveh, and he says, you're all going to die. It's too late. There's no mercy. There's no grace. Nahum is the darkest book in the Bible. Nahum tells Assyria, and he's speaking just 40 years before Nineveh falls to Babylon in 612. And Nahum says, you know how you ripped open our pregnant women and bashed our infants' heads open against the walls? That's what your enemy is going to do to you. And when Babylon came in and took Nineveh, and the historical story in archaeology is absolutely fascinating, how Nahum said, your walls are going to crumble and be overflown. And those bricks were made, they were dried bricks in the sun, and Nineveh had a flash flood in 612, just as the surrounding armies were going to give up and go home after a lengthy siege, and the walls collapsed. And the attacking armies of Babylon just marched in and took Nineveh and destroyed it. And it was destroyed so badly and buried so badly that it was thought to be legend until Henry Layard in the 1800s dug it up and saw, lo and behold, carved on the walls and in their records, all of the accounts of the siege of Lachish, of the siege on Jerusalem, all of those things carved in the walls, all found to be true history. Now, as happens, Babylon didn't last very long. Anybody remember that date for Babylon? Babylon's not a world power for very long. 539. In 539, Babylon falls to Cyrus. Cyrus is the king that Isaiah prophesied about, Isaiah in chapter 45. Here is Isaiah in the 700s prophesying about Cyrus, this guy 150 years later. And Isaiah says, "Cyrus, my servant." That's what any king on the face of the earth is to God. Doesn't mean Cyrus is a Hebrew believer. He says, "Cyrus, my servant." Cyrus in 539, he takes over all... Oh, we missed 586. We missed 586. It's a biggie. 586, what does Babylon do? They're the world power. They go down to Jerusalem. Jerusalem thinks we're invincible. Sennacherib came down in 701, and now it's 586, and they think, nope. What happened in 701 when Hezekiah was king? That's what will happen now. Babylon's not going to take Jerusalem. Nobody can take Jerusalem. And Babylon took Jerusalem. And not only did they take Jerusalem, they burned it to the ground. Every stone, every rock, they took it to the ground, destroyed it, and took all the Jews into captivity in three deportations. So in the first deportation, and you have a list of all the deportations so that you don't have to remember all this. In the deportations... of 605, 597, and 587. So the deportation in 605, before they destroyed Jerusalem, they took the rich and famous, and that would be Daniel. That's when Daniel goes to Babylon and is set up in the king's court. In 597, 10 years before the destruction, they come back, they take a few more, they take Ezekiel. Ezekiel is in Babylon prophesying. He sees the destruction of Jerusalem, doesn't he? Ezekiel's prophesying about all this destruction, and then he prophesies about the heavenly Jerusalem, which is a very different Jerusalem, and the different temple, which is a square temple, not an oblong temple. And then in 586, it's destroyed, and they take all these stragglers back to Babylon. And how long is the Babylonian captivity? 70 years. So you know if they were taken in 586, what will be the year that they're going to dedicate their new temple? What's 70 years later? 516. And 516 happens to be the year that they dedicate the new temple, 70 years later. The dedication of the temple. And these, the words are all in your little booklet. Let's see, let's not leave out any major bashings and smashings. So Cyrus, the first Persian guy, he comes in, he takes over Babylon, 539. The next year, 538, he looks around, he says, "What are all these Jews doing here? Let's send them all home." And he makes this, issues the Cyrus cylinder, and they send all the Jews home in several swaths. It would be during this Persian time. This would be during the time of Esther. Esther, actually 486. We can date Esther perfectly to 486 because of the Greek battles. She was married to King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, your Bible may say. And let's stop there since we're way over on time. Any questions on this? Just do you feel encouraged or empowered with some more Bible knowledge?
Yeah.
Isn't it cool just to know your Bible is there and true? Tara?
If anyone is interested, I read a really great book series last year called The Chronicles of Kings by Lynn Austin, and it covers that whole gory Solomon and Nehemiah reign in there, and all of King Hezekiah. There's a whole book dedicated to the tunnels, and it was so...
Wow.
All this stuff you're talking about is coming alive for me.
Yeah.
When you read historical fiction, it was historical fiction, but it was so culturally correct, and she did her research. So
yeah.
Everything you're talking about is making perfect sense. So I'll post it on Big Tent, and I totally recommend
Okay.
It was really educational for me. It's called The Chronicles of Kings, and there were five books.
The Chronicles
Lynn
of Kings, five books, Lynn Austin.
Really good.
Okay, five books, Lynn Austin.
And not dry, like I cried.
Okay, I'm going to say the Lord.